In this era of misinformation and claims of fake news, these words are essential and they are in question. Noted historian Jill Lepore, taking them on. She dedicated the first season of her podcast to the search for truth. The podcast is called The Last Archive, and she's back for season two, this time tracking the rise of doubt through the last 100 years of American history.
This place, this evidence room, stores the facts that matter and matters of fact. It's all that stands between a reasonable doubt and the chaos of ignorance. It lies in a time between now and then. The sign on the door reads, The Last Archive.
Jill Lepore joins us now, Harvard professor, author, staff writer at The New Yorker, and host of The Last Archive. Jill Lepore, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
So I am excited to talk about season two. The first episode is on the Scopes Monkey Trial, but first things first. Take a second, look back on your first season now, and reflect for us on the core question you set out to ask when you started this whole thing last year. Who killed truth?
Sure. Yeah, it's a very serious question, but I think your little audio clip there suggests that the podcast is also a little campy. And one of the things we set
it's
out
the
to
right
do
amount
is
of campy.
Just have a lot of fun as audiophiles, just playing with sound. You get to do that all day. But it was really fun for me to do as a person who spends my time in paper archives, right? Rustling through old diary entries. And it was really fun to tell stories in this format and to play with the conventions of radio drama and, you know, kind of shout outs to the Twilight Zone. But the first season really took the form of a whodunit, a kind of 1930s gumshoe investigation. Who killed truth? It's a question that animates our political discourse, that of course has animated philosophers of all times. Like this is, it seems like a national emergency right now, this question. But of course, it's an evergreen, right? We're always wondering about how people get away with lying, right? That's part of the human condition. But the first season tried to historicize the problem by saying, well, let's look at the last century. Like, let's just take like a useful unit of time, a century, and kind of go decade by decade and try to identify moments or events or villains that kind of undermined the means by which we get to the bottom of things. Established rules for knowing were being toppled. And that's kind of how the first season worked. And we had a whole bunch of different suspects. But at the end, it kind of, I don't know, maybe this is kind of cheap, but it seemed like we kind of got to a Murder on the Orient Express kind of outcome where, you know, someone stabbed the victim. Poisoned him. It's like everybody did it. Like you could look to Trump, you could look to Mark Zuckerberg, you could think about postmodernism. Like they're kind of the usual suspects all had a hand, but actually there's a kind of long story actually across the 20th century that we decided in the second season to revisit kind of through a different lens.
So let's talk about this fun that you just said that you had. You know, as an historian, what were you able to bring alive doing this as a podcast, you know, that you can't bring alive when you're working just on paper?
Yeah. So in the first season, for instance, I had written a New Yorker essay about Rachel Carson and her relationship to the sea and all of her writing about the sea and how we forget that Carson, long before she wrote Silent Spring, which, you know, really launched the modern environmental movement, had been a scientist and a sort of basically a marine biologist and a writer about the sea. I wanted to do an episode about Carson, and we decided we had this an episode of the first season called For the Birds, where I became fascinated as I reexamined what I had learned about Carson researching her papers, which are at the Beinecke Library at Yale, that she talks all the time about sound, the sound of the ocean, the sound of different creatures, but especially the sound of birds. She was a big birder from early childhood. And we came across this story. I came across a story of how she adopted basically her grandnephew as a little boy, and a friend sent him as a present an album of bird song. It's like called American Bird Song, and it was made by this Cornell Lab of Ornithology. And so we did a kind of whole episode about what the body of evidence is that is the sounds that birds make. So the whole episode really is just full of bird song as a body of evidence that, you know, as a historian, again, you know, working with numbers and working with objects, I just don't really work with sound. But there is something really phenomenal about what the, and in the Silent Spring, right, the Sound Spring, which I'd never somehow really reckoned with. Oh yeah, the silence is the birds are not making noise. The birds have stopped singing because of DDT and the pollution that isn't, that is affecting all these different species through pesticides that, you know, the birds eat the bugs that are poisoned. So it's kind of that kind of thinking through historical problems through the audio trail that's left behind. So that was a way we sort of thought about that in the first season, but in the second season. So for instance, we have an episode about Nazi radio propaganda because the FCC was hugely concerned about shortwave radio broadcasts from Radio Berlin during the 1930s and 1940s. They were so concerned that they had a listening post in Maryland, in Silver Spring, Maryland, where they tried to capture them all, right, and record them with very primitive recording devices. And those records still exist. They also went, you know, after D-Day, U.S. intelligence agents went all through Berlin looking for recordings that Radio Berlin had made of its own propaganda. So we have an episode about how radio propaganda worked during the Second World War and how so much of what we think of as now as trolling, online trolling, really is genealogically the descendants of Nazi radio propaganda. So much of the methods of inciting doubt in people by kind of hijacking their attention comes from Nazi radio propaganda. So we used all these broadcasts by Americans who had worked for the Nazis and were later tried for treason.
All right, you've made so many references just now to something that came out in the news today that I gotta ask you. You talked about the murder on the Orient Express and all the different people who killed Truth, including President Trump and Facebook. You just talked about trolling, and that was often an accusation of the president. So today, Facebook's oversight board upheld their ban of President Trump from the social media site. As an historian who went back and looked at that and put those two on the train, what is your reaction to that news today? And do you think that was a necessary step given what history tells us about truth and doubt?
Oh, it was absolutely a necessary step, but I think it's wholly inadequate to the size of the problem. I mean, I don't mean to use the cliche of the Band-Aid over the gaping wound, but we're looking at a patient who's losing blood, has lost, you know, a lot of blood already. I just don't think the Band-Aid is going to work. I mean, when you look historically at the problem of the relationship between communications technologies and how we know things, right, they're inextricable. So, you know, our nation is founded historically on the idea of a free press, with the idea that printing, taking a publicly stated position is a very unusual thing. It's pretty scarce, right? There are printing presses and you can write for them, but not everybody's participating in that. And there, it's like a whole lot of steps of editorial judgment that go into, you know, an 18th century notion. I mean, it's not unlike, say, you know, we talk about, oh, AK-47s, were they really what Madison could have imagined when he drafted the language that became the Second Amendment? Right? Like, these people are basically using guns that you could fire like once a day that are like really hard to carry around. How could we really import that understanding of what arms are in the 18th century down to gun regulation questions or gun safety questions or gun rights issues today? The same thing is true with speech and public discourse, right? Like, we are looking at machinery that was utterly unanticipated by anyone in the 18th century, and that defies the very structures that are designed to allow for the consent of the governed, a political realm that involves political opportunities of expression, that involves political equality and equal rights for citizens. Like, there's just this huge gap between the set of political ideas in our constitutional framework and how communication exists today. And so the Facebook Oversight Board, which is this quasi legal, it doesn't really have authority over Facebook. Facebook is not answerable to anyone in some ways in the way that it's been erected. I'm glad they didn't reinstate Trump's Facebook account, but gosh, it's a very, very minor patch.
All right. So there's this question that's kind of welling up as I listen to you. It feels like, as an historian and with your intellect, what you have developed with this podcast is a catbird seat. To actually say, while everyone else or many of us are saying, what is happening? You are saying, I know what is happening. And one part of it is an assault on truth, and one part of it is doubt. So what does that even mean? What is happening with doubt that is a thing you're doing an entire season of podcast on as historian?
Yeah, well, actually, you know, this season of The Last Archive, we produced entirely during the pandemic. So doing kind of field reporting that, you know, heroic NPR reporters went out and did during the pandemic at risk to their own lives. It's not something that I did during the pandemic, I'm embarrassed to say. We did a lot of audio archive searching, and I did a lot of interviewing in order to try to actually examine the question of how much more tenuous is our grasp on what is true and what is not true when we are isolated and when our only way of really experiencing much of the world is through the mediation of technologies of communication, right? So actually the pandemic ended up being, you know, an opportunity for us to examine these questions rather than a problem, because it is kind of hard to know, like, that sense of like, what is going on when you're just kind of checking out the world by way of a computer screen all day. That, I think, in our lifetimes, in the last, you know, 24 months, most people have experienced some version of that. And I think that really is the story of the last 100 years, right? The rise of mass communications has both connected people to one another and built communities, but also weirdly distanced people from direct observation of the world. And that's, so you know, in the internet space,
we're more connected and yet more isolated.
Yeah. I mean, we have these seeming connections, right? And I don't mean to minimize them. Like, I remember when I lived in Michigan, when I had lived in Massachusetts for a long time, and I moved to Michigan, and I remember listening to Car Talk and feeling like I was at home. Like, there was this way that, you know, that this power that voice has to make you feel like I'm with this person. We're so intimate together right now. Like, you and I, it's as if we're in the same room. But that's also an illusion. Like, I was not in Massachusetts. I don't know what was going on in Massachusetts. I was living in Michigan. And if Car Talk had decided to tell me that, you know, you should buy a Ford, but not buy a Chevy, I wouldn't really have had a direct way to figure that out. Do you know what I mean? Like, so it's both about connected to one another, these seeming intimacies, but also about needing to trust people at a great distance, which is, you know, one of the great advantages of these technologies of communication. But these things tend to require regulations with regard to how people, whether people can tell you things that are true or not. And that has been the nature of American broadcasting for much of the last century, but it has really fallen apart.
So first, I'm just going to give you props for working Car Talk into a conversation about truth and doubt. Nicely done. We have like a minute left, so we have time for a couple of sentences from you about what you think needs to happen, like, now, this year.
Oh, now this year, I think we do. I'm very supportive of civics education initiatives, which I think involve a lot of media literacy by definition. I do think that there's some great ways. We really need to dedicate huge amounts of resources as a nation, as a state, as a municipality here in Boston, to public education and to recovering from the ravages of the pandemic and the asymmetrical way in which those affected kids. But I actually think it's a really interesting opportunity to use that rededication to public education to wrestle with problems of how we know things and how we prove things, to kind of, I think, also strengthen our willingness to disagree with people and to together use the tools of, say, historical inquiry to learn how to get to the bottom of something, which is just how journalism and science works as well. I have a lot of optimism about public education.
Well, we are kindred spirits in that, it's true. And there's so much more that we could talk about. Noted historian, Harvard professor, author, and staff writer at The New Yorker, Jill Lepore. Will you come back and talk to us again?
Yeah, thanks so much. It's a lot of fun.
Jill Lepore's podcast is called The Last Archive, and the first episode of season 2 is available now.